How old is Jupiter's red spot? Watching a supermassive black hole wake up, the earliest merging quasars, and Starliner still hasn't come home. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. The Great Red Spot is Jupiter's most memorable feature. It's this gigantic anticyclonic storm that is raging across the surface of Jupiter and has been doing so for hundreds of years. In fact, there is historical evidence that astronomers as early as Cassini back in the 1600s observed this giant storm on Jupiter. In fact, Cassini, when he saw it, called it a persistent spot. And then astronomers lost track of it for some reason. And then it was picked up again in the 1800s, and there's been fairly continuous observations since then. Now, back when it was observed in the 1800s, the Great Red Spot was about 39,000 kilometers across, but it has been declining, shrinking over time, and now it's down to only about 14,000 kilometers across. Now, that's still huge. You could still fit the Earth inside the Great Red Spot, but it is still getting smaller. But astronomers have always assumed that this object that Cassini saw is the Great Red Spot back then, but maybe it was like wasn't quite fully grown, and then we saw the one in the 1800s, and now it's the one that we see today. But researchers have gone and simulated various storms in the region, and they think, in fact, that it wasn't the same storm that people were seeing. That Cassini was seeing one storm, a fairly large storm that lasted for a while, and then it disappeared. And then the Great Red Spot showed up, and that was what was seen by astronomers. And that would explain it, because telescopes were getting better, more and more eyes were on the sky, and yet this very obvious feature was just missing from the planet for about 100 years. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we see various objects. There's one called like Oval BA, and there's smaller storms that grow, they merge. And at the same time, we can see that the Great Red Spot itself is starting to shrink. And so it might be that the Great Red Spot is actually a lot younger than we ever thought, and it's probably not gonna last for too much longer. Astronomers see a supermassive black hole wake up in real time. Astronomers are pretty sure there is a supermassive black hole at the heart of nearly every galaxy in the universe. This is something with millions, even billions of times the mass of the sun. And these black holes can be quiet or they can be active. When they're active, they are feeding on material. And when the configuration is exactly right, we see these as quasars. These are just these incredibly bright star-like objects, but they are billions of light years away. And so out in the universe, we see quiet galaxies and we see active galaxies, but we've never seen that transition from a quiet galaxy to an active galaxy until now. Astronomers were watching a galaxy that is 300 million light years away, and they saw the central core of the galaxy start to brighten. And this is common. When a supermassive black hole consumes a large cloud of gas or even a star, you get something called a tidal disruption event, where the thing is torn apart. You get the brightened debris from the snack that the black hole has had, but they peak in brightness and then they fade away over the course of about 100 days. But for some reason, the center of this galaxy started to brighten and has continued brightening now for about 4 years. And so astronomers think, no, this isn't just a one-time event, but in fact, this is the black hole switching over from this quiescent stage into this active phase. And to certain observers, this might turn into a quasar. Now, there's a lot of other possible explanations. You know, it might just be that it's still a tidal disruption event. It's just happening a lot more slowly. The black hole is savoring its meal. But if it's true, this is the first time that we are seeing a black hole become an active galaxy, which is really cool. And speaking of quasars, astronomers have seen a pair of quasars merging less than a billion years after the Big Bang. This is the earliest quasar collision that's ever been seen. Now, astronomers know of plenty of quasars that are within that first billion years of the universe's history. They know of about 300. But never have they seen two of them in the process of merging. The observations were made with the Subaru telescope and the Gemini North Observatory, and we're seeing these quasars come together about 900 million years after the Big Bang. both of these supermassive black holes are about 100 million times the mass of the Sun, which is about the same as the mass of the supermassive black hole at the heart of Andromeda. Now, the merger has just begun. The galaxies are close together. There is this bridge of gas connecting the two centers. Over time, the two black holes will get closer and closer and eventually merge, but it's going to take hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of years for us to see. And of course, it happened shortly after the Big Bang, and so it has already happened, but we need to wait for the light to reach us to see it. An explanation for the Crab Nebula. We got a cool new image from JWST. This is the Crab Nebula, which is a very famous supernova remnant. It was first seen in 1054 CE and was seen by astronomers around the world. It was so bright that you could actually see it during the day. And now the remnant is one of the objects that you can see in a small telescope. It looks like this faint puff of gas and dust. But of course, if you point James Webb at this region, you get this incredible image. And so the one you're looking at was made using Webb's MIRI instrument and the NIRCam instrument, and just shows you all of the subtle gas and dust and the tendrils of material, the debris cloud left when a star exploded. Now, based on the composition of the nebula, astronomers always thought that it was a kind of strange supernova, a very rare type, an unevolved core. So unlike the traditional normal core collapse supernovae, where a star gathers mass until it reaches iron at the core and then implodes on itself and detonates, astronomers believe that the Crab Nebula supernova had more less evolved elements in the core. So things like oxygen, neon, and magnesium, and it still was able to have a core collapse and explode as a supernova. But Webb found that that's probably not the case, that in fact there is evidence that it was a more traditional core collapse supernova with iron embedded into the nebula. Cool science, but mostly this was just a chance to show you a cool picture of the Crab Nebula taken by Webb. Every week we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what was the coolest space news story of the week. And this week, another landslide. You're all excited about the new upcoming Naked Eye Nova, despite me trying to manage your expectations. I agree, it's cool. I can't wait to see it. Now, we post the new vote into the community tab on our channel within about 24 hours of when we publish Space Bites. So keep an eye out for it there, or just while you're scrolling on YouTube, you should see the vote show up. Let us know what you thought was the coolest story, and we will celebrate it next week. Now, the best chance to see the vote, subscribe to the channel, click on the notifications bell, watch a bunch of our videos, feed the algorithm. All hail the algorithm. A new way to survive a night on the moon. We've been watching missions going to the moon, and the question that always comes up at the end of the lunar day is, will the spacecraft survive the lunar night? Many don't. The occasional one, like Japan's Slimlander, actually survived the lunar night multiple nights, and then they die. But is there a way to dependably survive 14 days of frigid cold temperature? And it's important to just understand the temperature regime that a spacecraft has to deal with. During the day, the temperatures rise to 127 Celsius, and then at night, the temperatures plunge to negative 173 Celsius. So that is a huge temperature range that your spacecraft has to be able to survive. And in order to survive the lunar night, you have to be able to keep your instruments warm, which means you have to have a battery. And the battery has to be able to use electricity for 14 days, which is really tricky. And so in order to minimize the amount of energy you use to keep your spacecraft warm during the lunar night, you need to insulate it. But if you insulate it, then it makes it really hard to shed heat during the day. It is a really tricky problem. So researchers in Japan have come up with a really cool heat distribution piping system for spacecraft. And what it'll do is be able to switch between running warm fluids and cold fluids through the spacecraft, depending on whether it's trying to get through the lunar night or whether it's trying to survive the heat of the lunar day. And what's cool about this is that it could sort of switch between these two modes, but when it's not needed, if the temperatures don't need to be regulated, then it can shut off and not use up any heat at all. And so in theory, we could see future spacecraft equipped with this thermal modulating system that will allow it to both remain active during the day, and then be able to survive the lunar night without using too much of its electricity. Fish could help farming on Mars. If and when humans go to Mars, they're going to need to figure out a way to live off the land. You can't just bring all of the food that the astronauts are going to need from Earth. They need to be able to grow that on Mars. And do you remember The Martian? Do you remember how Mark Watney dug up the Martian regolith and he knew that there was no bacteria in the soil and so it wouldn't be able to grow any plants. And so he used the poop of all of his fellow astronauts to be able to provide those nutrients. That would probably work, but it was pretty gross. So researchers have thought about other ways that you could deliver that nutrient to the Mars regolith. And they think fish are going to be the best way. They raise tilapia in pools, then use the effluent, the water that the fish were living in that had the fish poop in it, and they mix that in with simulated Martian regolith. And from there, they were able to grow a variety of plants, including potatoes. And of course, you know, the tilapia will provide a form of protein when you're on Mars. So it could very well be when there's researchers on Mars, they're going to have an aquarium filled with tilapia that will then help provide the nutrients for their farm. And then, of course, one other issue with Mars regolith is the perchlorates, very toxic substances that are mixed in with the regolith. Now, I did a whole interview about a way to maybe remove those perchlorates from the regolith so that you could then actually grow plants in it. So we'll put a link to that here. When is Starliner coming home? Stuckliner. That's a good title. Now, last week, I let you know about Starliner docking with the International Space Station and told you that by the time next week's Space Bites was out, we'd know what happened. Well, here we are. It's next week's Space Bites, and we don't know what happened. That's because the Starliner is still attached to the International Space Station. NASA is running through a battery of tests, really trying to understand the issues, and have pushed back the return to Earth. Now we're looking at a return of June the 25th, so I guess I'll let you know how it turns out next week. But they have been doing a bunch of tests to try and get to the bottom of the problem. They powered up one of the thrusters, measured the amount of helium leaks that are happening, and it all seems fine. So it has enough thrusters to be able to undock from the space station, to be able to reorient itself and re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, that the helium leaks aren't going to be critical for the amount of time that they'll need to be able to operate the spacecraft to return to Earth. And so, assuming nothing new pops up, this spacecraft will probably detach on June 25th. But it has not been a smooth ride. And so, based on all of the issues that have come up, it probably won't be until the middle of 2025 before we see Starliner actually get used for operational flights. But I'll keep you posted. All right, I got a series of really cool images to show you. So first up, Hubble Space Telescope is back, and now it's operating on its single gyro mode. So if you remember, the telescope went into safe mode because one of its three remaining gyros was having some problems. And NASA knew this was going to be an issue, and they were prepared with a single gyro operating mode. So it's happiest with three, it can work with two, and it can even do science with one. So what they did was they changed to single gyro mode, and they left the other fully functional gyro in reserve, and they're able to go back to their science operations. The downside is the telescope slews a little more slowly than it did before, so it won't be able to gather as much science, but it's still almost as good and will allow it to conserve its remaining gyros and for many years to come. So the image that you're looking at is called NGC 1546. It's a galaxy in the constellation Dorado. And, you know, there's nothing super special about this. It's at a nice angle, so you can see the dust lanes through the disk of the galaxy. You can see pockets of star formation and spiral arms. You can see that bright core at the center of the galaxy. It's a nice galaxy picture, and it shows that Hubble Space Telescope is back in business. Now, this image is going to blow your mind. This is an image of a piece of space junk. It is the upper stage of a Japanese rocket. The image was taken with Astroscale's Address J spacecraft, and its job is to demonstrate, to test out various technologies to get close and observe and analyze a piece of space debris. So we shared an image several weeks ago, and now this one is from only 50 meters away. And it's so cool to see a high resolution image of a piece of space junk, something that is hurtling overhead at 28,000 kilometers per hour. And yet this spacecraft was able to get close to it, almost touching. It's going to get closer, so we should see some more images in the future, but everything that has been learned by Astroscale, they're going to use for a future actual debris removal mission. So that's going to be coming in the future. And finally, we've got an image of China's Chang'e 6 seen from orbit. And this, of course, was the recent sample return mission that went to the far side of the moon. Now, in this image, you can see this sort of white dot at the center of the picture. That is the lander. You can see the plume of lighter material around it where its exhaust fired as it was landing on the surface of the moon. Very cool. It drilled a couple of meters down, gathered up its samples, put it into an ascent module that is on its way home and should also be returning on June 25th. I wonder which is going to come first, Starliner or the Chinese samples. But we also got a really cool image from a second rover that the lander was carrying, and it deployed it out onto the surface of the moon. It only weighed about 5 kilograms. And it appears that its main job was to take a picture of the lander, which is so cool. Like, China's selfie game is strong. They've had micro spacecraft with many of their recent missions, so they can actually get an image of their spacecraft in orbit or on the surface of the moon or on Mars or whatever. It's really cool. Now, you're watching Space Bites, but I'm writing this week's weekly email newsletter, which I send out to about 70,000 of my closest friends. So many more stories that we covered on Universe Today that you're not going to see here or almost anywhere else. For example, a new simulation that explains how supermassive black holes grew so quickly. How almost a third of the early galaxies were already spirals. And how an astronaut might need kidney dialysis on the way home from Mars. So you can subscribe to this weekly email newsletter. Go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. It's completely free. There's no advertisements in it. I write every word, so you should definitely go and check it out. I'm going to talk about a recent interview that I did that I'm really proud of, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew M. Gross, David Giltinan, David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Monzo, Paul Warbach, Stephen Grisaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Chipolin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. So the time you're watching this, an interview that I just did came out a couple of days ago. And that's an interview I did with Mansur Tesaev about an air-breathing ion engine. And I have been fascinated with this concept for several years since I first saw them. And I've been reaching out to researcher after researcher and nobody gets back to me. And finally, someone from Surrey Space got back to me and was able to schedule this interview. And it was everything that I was hoping to hear. He was able to explain in detail how these air-breathing ion engines work and what the potentials are and what the challenges are and how we might be able to move forward to be able to see prototypes flying in the future. I love this idea because the spacecraft doesn't need any fuel to make electricity. It's just solar power, so it has solar panels. And it doesn't need propellant, which all spacecraft do because it's harvesting its propellant right out of the air and then accelerating it with electricity. So it was a fascinating interview, one of my favorites that I've done in a while, and I think you'll enjoy it too. So if you skipped it, definitely check this one out. All right, we'll see you next week.